Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Adjudication and Jurisdiction Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On April 16, 2013, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Genesis Healthcare Corporation v. Simchick. This case concerned the scope of the federal court's power to adjudicate cases. The question was whether a case becomes moot, and must therefore be dismissed, when the lone plaintiff in an uncertified collective action under the Fair Labor Standards Act receives an offer from all defendants to satisfy her claims in full. In an opinion delivered by Justice Thomas, the court held by a vote of 5-4 that the plaintiff's suit was appropriately dismissed for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. Chief Justice Roberts and Justices Scalia, Kennedy, and Alito joined the majority opinion. Justice Kagan filed a dissenting opinion, which was joined by Justices Ginsburg, Breyer, and Sotomayor. To discuss the case, we have Mark Mahler, who's an associate professor of law at DePaul University College of Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
I'm Mark Mahler, professor at the DePaul College of Law, and I'm going to be talking about the court's recent decision in Genesis Healthcare Corporation v. Simchick. So I'll start off by just recounting the facts of the case. It's a complicated decision, and it's helpful to keep in mind exactly what's going on in this case in order to understand the court's ruling. So in this case, the respondent, Laura Simchick, was a nurse who was employed by Genesis Healthcare Corporation. And she filed a claim for damages because Genesis, her employer, allegedly failed to pay her for work performed during meal breaks, something that's prohibited by the Fair Labor Standards Act. But she also brought what's called a collective action on behalf of other employees who were similarly not compensated for work during meal breaks. Collective actions are a type of representative procedure authorized by the Fair Labor Standards Act. In that context, Congress has taken Rule 23, the rule of federal procedure that governs class actions, offline and replaced it with a specialized representative procedure that's specifically applicable to Fair Labor Standards Act claims. And Fair Labor Standards Act collective actions are similar in some ways to the class actions that we all know and love, but very different in some other important ways. So they're similar in the following sense. Both Fair Labor Standards Act collective actions and class actions are initiated by a named plaintiff who comes into court and sues on behalf of persons outside of court who share or alleged to share similar interests with them. Fair Labor Standards collective actions are distinct from class actions, though, because in a Fair Labor Standards Act collective action, the named plaintiff is empowered to represent only those absentees who affirmatively opt into the collective action. That's different from class actions, as most listeners will be familiar. In class actions, the representative is authorized to represent all of those persons who do not opt out of the class action. The problem in this case stems from the defendant's strategic use of an offer of judgment under Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 68 to try and defeat federal jurisdiction over Ms. Simchick's collective action. Offers of judgment are a somewhat kind of dusty procedural device in the federal rules. They're not often used, so I think it's helpful to just discuss quickly what offers of judgment are. They're basically a fee-shifting device contained, as I said, in Federal Rule 68, and they work like this. If a defendant serves an offer to consent to a judgment on certain terms, which plaintiff rejects, and plaintiff then goes on to prevail but recovers less than the offer, then the plaintiff must pay the costs incurred by the defendant after the offer was rejected. The hope of the rulemakers here was that the offer of judgment rule would encourage settlements on fair terms. They would encourage defendants to make fair settlement offers, They would encourage plaintiffs to accept those offers. And in the process, they would protect defendants from the burden of litigation costs incurred defending against claims by truculent plaintiffs unwilling to accept a fair deal. So back to our case, shortly after the plaintiff filed her collective action, the defendants made an offer of judgment under Rule 68 that would have given the plaintiff everything she was seeking on her own claim. So compensation for all of her unpaid wages, in addition to reasonable attorney's fees, costs, and expenses to be determined by the court. The plaintiff didn't accept the offer, and after she rejected it, the defendant then filed a motion to dismiss for lack of jurisdiction, arguing that the offer of judgment mooted her action. To understand this argument, it helps to review some basic federal jurisdiction points. So everyone knows Article 3 limits federal court's jurisdiction to cases or controversies. And for an actual Article 3 controversy to subsist between a plaintiff and a defendant, a plaintiff must demonstrate that he or she possesses a legally cognizable interest or personal stake in the outcome of the action. Moreover, that controversy must be extant or continuing at all stages of the case, not merely at the time the complaint is filed. So if, accordingly, something happens after the suit is filed to eliminate the plaintiff's personal stake in the action, in other words, something that moots her claim, federal jurisdiction goes away and the suit must be dismissed. The defendant's argument here was that the offer of judgment by providing the plaintiff with complete relief mooted her claim, requiring dismissal of the case for lack of jurisdiction. The district court agreed. It found the offer mooted her claim and it dismissed the entire action, including her collective action claims, for lack of jurisdiction. The Third Circuit reversed. It agreed that the plaintiff's individual claims were mooted by the offer of judgment, but it held her collective action claims, which weren't the subject of the offer of judgment, weren't moot, and jurisdiction continued to lay with respect to those claims. The court took the case, and the question presented two questions. So first, does an unaccepted offer of judgment moot a named plaintiff's claim? And second, if in fact a named plaintiff's claims are mooted by such an offer, does jurisdiction still lie over collective action claims asserted by that plaintiff? So let's start with the first issue. The first issue is the subject of a circuit split. The Second Circuit, for example, has held an offer of judgment that provides a plaintiff with complete relief doesn't moot the plaintiff's claim unless the offer is either accepted or a judgment is entered for the plaintiff based on the offer. Other circuits, including the Third, as illustrated in this case, disagree. They've held that an unaccepted offer does moot a plaintiff's claim if the offer, again, provides complete relief. The idea is that the defendant's willingness to provide complete relief is by itself sufficient to show there's no real controversy between the plaintiff and the defendant that justifies the exercise of federal jurisdiction. So the majority in Genesis did not decide which understanding of the jurisdictional effect of an offer of judgment was right, because the plaintiff unwisely conceded that the offer in the case mooted her own claim and therefore waived arguments to the contrary. It did, however, reach the second question, whether, assuming the plaintiff's own claims were moot, federal courts retained jurisdiction over the collective action that the plaintiff brought on behalf of other similarly situated Genesis employees. And in a 5-4 decision written by Justice Thomas, the court reversed the Third Circuit, holding no jurisdiction lay over the collective action claims. The heart of its Justice Thomas's reasoning is the following principle, that jurisdiction generally requires throughout the life of a lawsuit a case or controversy between persons with party status. If a plaintiff's claims are mooted and no one else with party status is left in the action with a live controversy with the defendant, jurisdiction is at an end. And that was the case here. In a Fair Labor Standards Act collective action, Absentees who the named plaintiff purports to represent don't obtain party status until they opt in to the collective action. This is actually different than the understanding of party status in the class action context. In that context, class members obtain party status when a class is certified. In a Fair Labor Standards Act collective action, by contrast, it's not until individual employees opt into the collective action after the collective action is conditionally certified that they obtain party status. And in this case, no absentees had actually opted in to the plaintiff's action. As a result, plaintiff was the only party in the action, and once plaintiff's claims were mooted by the offer of judgment, there was no one left with a controversy with the defendant that could ground federal jurisdiction. That was the court's basic reasoning. The plaintiff in the case appealed to some class action cases dating back to the 1970s that had relaxed the principle that jurisdiction requires a live controversy between parties to the action. In these cases, in the class action context, the court, starting with Sosna v. Iowa, rescued federal court's jurisdiction over class claims despite the presence of, if you will, a jurisdictional gap between the moment that the named plaintiff's claims become moot and the moment that the class obtains party status. Plaintiff in Genesis appealed to this line of cases and argued that it should carry over to Fair Labor Standards Act cases like hers. But the court essentially limited these class action cases to the class action context. So that's the overview of the decision. I want to turn to talk about its implications, starting first with its implications in Fair Labor Standards Act suits. It's somewhat hard to know what to make of the decision, in large part because the holding in the case turns on a major premise, the merits of which the court just doesn't decide, namely that an unaccepted offer of judgment moots named plaintiff's claims. The court simply takes this as a given because the plaintiff waived arguments to the contrary. And if that premise turns out to be wrong, as Justice Kagan noted in a very punchy dissent, the holding here isn't of much significance in future Fair Labor Standards Act actions. Nonetheless, at the tea leaf level, if you will, I think the decision is more significant than Justice Kagan suggests in her dissent. It almost certainly signals that a majority on the court accepts the Third Circuit's view that an unaccepted offer of judgment does moot a named plaintiff's claim. I doubt the majority would have been willing to decide the case based on an uncontested premise unless the majority thought that premise is probably right. The tea leaves in the decision, I think, also point toward some interesting implications outside of the Fair Labor Standards Act context for class action. So, as I mentioned, there were a series of cases dating from the 1970s that adopt a fairly flexible approach to mootness in the class context. And Justice Thomas's opinion reviews these cases in the course of his decision, in part to make the point that they're not relevant beyond the class action context and therefore aren't relevant to Genesis, which, as we talked about, doesn't involve a class action. Even so, Justice Thomas engages in a lengthy discussion of each of kind of the key 1970s class action mootness cases. And the way he describes these decisions is, I think, significant because he interprets them in a way that is really narrower than the prevailing understanding of these cases in the lower circuits. So the prevailing approach to mootness in the class context, based again on these 1970s era cases, upholds jurisdiction over class claims so long as the named plaintiff has asserted and pressed class claims by filing a motion to certify a class before her own claims are mooted. So these decisions, in effect, make a motion to certify a class action kind of the jurisdictional event horizon. If a named plaintiff files a motion to certify a class action, her claims become moot after she files that motion. Courts have upheld jurisdiction over the class claims, reasoning that by filing a motion to certify, plaintiff has indicated that she has a stake or interest in the class claims. By contrast, Justice Thomas's opinion emphasizes repeatedly that it's the certification decision, not the motion to certify, that has jurisdictional consequences. So he goes through each of these cases and basically describes them as cases that extend no further than their facts. So he starts with Sozna v. Iowa, which is the first case in this line of 1970s decisions. And he characterizes it as a case that upholds jurisdiction over certified claims, even if the named plaintiff's claims are mooted after the class is certified. He then goes on to talk about United States Postal Commission v. Garrity, the next major decision in this line of cases. And he characterizes it as a narrow extension of Sozna that upholds jurisdiction over appeals from a denial of certification when the named plaintiff's claims are mooted after the certification denial. In each case, Justice Thomas characterizes the fact that district courts resolve the certification motion before the named plaintiff's claims are mooted as kind of the trigger that saves jurisdiction over the class claims. Lower courts have justified treating the certification motion as a jurisdictional trigger based on a concern that class claims are transitory, meaning they will evade review if a class action is dismissed on jurisdictional grounds because the named plaintiff's claims are moot. Justice Thomas, however, characterizes the transitory claim exception to mootness as one that is limited to cases in which the underlying conduct that is the subject of the suit is transitory, as in cases where plaintiffs are seeking to enjoin a practice like pretrial detentions that are short in duration or subject to change at any moment. By contrast, he says, where class members have damages claims that are not running up against a limitations period and are capable of being asserted in independent standalone actions by class members if jurisdiction over the class action is dismissed, the transitory exception to mootness principles, he says, doesn't apply. In that context, the class members' claims aren't transitory. They're quite durable. The fact that four other justices signed on to this discussion of the class mootness cases, I think, is a hint that there now may be a majority view on the court for the proposition that if class members' claims are mooted before the district court renders a certification decision, jurisdiction is at an end, at least if class members would be capable of vindicating their rights by filing their own suits. Also along these lines, Justice Thomas actually cast doubt on some concrete aspects of the 1970s decision. So, for example, in Deposit Guarantee National Bank v. Roper, the court suggested that a named plaintiff's interest in shifting litigation costs to the class in the event of a settlement or a judgment in favor of the class is sufficient to give the named plaintiff a stake in the action, even if her own claims have been mooted by, for example, an offer of judgment, a sufficient stake that would allow the named plaintiff to appeal a denial of class cert. In Genesis, Justice Thomas refers to this portion of Roper, the suggestion in Roper, repeatedly as dicta, and he goes out of his way to note that it has since been called into question by later decisions. And again, I would take that as a signal of sorts that there may be a majority out there willing to reconsider the merits of this suggestion in Roper. So the bottom line, if you take these characterizations of the class mootness cases for all they are worth, it hints that there may be a majority on the court for two views. First, if named plaintiffs' claims are mooted before the class cert decision, but class members are capable of vindicating their rights through separate suits, no jurisdiction. The entire action has to be dismissed for lack of jurisdiction. Second, if named plaintiffs' claims on the merits are mooted after a decision denying class cert, federal courts retain jurisdiction to hear an appeal from the denial of certification, but the named plaintiff would lack standing to prosecute that appeal, and some other member of the class would have to be added as a named plaintiff in order to press the appeal of the class cert decision. The named plaintiff's interest in shifting costs to the class in the event of a settlement or judgment isn't sufficient by itself to ground the named plaintiff's standing to press that appeal. Both of those hints, I think, are really pretty significant. They mark a departure from the conventional view of class standing that's developed in the lower circuits. It's hard to tell in these kinds of cases how much we can actually read into a decision like this about what a majority on the court thinks. Nonetheless, I think there's some indication here that there is a majority that's willing to reconsider in a pretty deep way the law of mootness in the class context as well.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.